Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. Donna Sebo here. I am so delighted that you're able to join me for our special program, Warriors for Peace. There is a quote that I have in front of me that says, "An awful game is war, not just the blood and gore, when orphans weep and widows keep a vigil at the door. A soldier falls in pain to never rise again. To those he leaves, and she who grieves, forever is the game." My guest today is George Stein. His publication is Sing Before Breakfast. This is a story about Gettysburg, a battle that occurred on U.S. soil that to this day has so many aspects to it that it's just amazing to be able to even comprehend what went on at a time in American history that still has lessons to teach us. And George Stein, in writing his book, Sing Before Breakfast, A Story of Gettysburg, has a lot of wisdom to share. Today's world is a very violent one. We have daily in the news all kinds of statements that indicate that perhaps war is going to begin again in another part of the world. I want to welcome to the show, Warriors for Peace, George Stein. Hello, George.
Hello, Donna.
George, your book, Sing Before Breakfast, really is a labor of love. You did a great deal of research on this. Why, George, did you decide that this was something you really wanted to write about? Why is it that the Battle of Gettysburg is so significant? And how is it that for you, it became such an important part of your life?
Well, it goes way back. And in 1959, I made my first trip to Gettysburg. I took a relative there who wanted to go. I lived about 100 miles from it. And it was such an overwhelming experience. We had a government guide who took us around and described the events of the 3 days. And I was so overwhelmed by it. At one point, I felt that I had been there. And it was very compelling to write about and to experience. I've since been back to Gettysburg perhaps 30 or 40 times, and it's always something new. It's always fresh. It's a beautiful place. Its fields are not that extensive that you can't walk them, and you're allowed to go anywhere in Gettysburg. But, you know, one of the things I think in my memory that made me want to write about it was that a long time ago, I think it was on the 100th anniversary, 1963, Walter Cronkite took Carl Sandburg, a walk on the battlefield with Carl Sandburg, and it was called Sandburg at Gettysburg. And Carl Sandburg went on to describe the horror of the battlefield. I'll never forget it, about what happens to men that are struck by the weapons of those days. And so that and accumulating interest in reading about it, it made me want to set something down on paper. I chose the 12-year-old boy as an example of, I could ask any question And it wouldn't be naive. It would be naive, but that was all that would be preventable. So that's why the youngster is the main character in the book.
Now, most of the characters in your book, Sing Before Breakfast, are about really people that you've known. You have, for example, the main character, Chester. He is, well, he's got his name from the surnames of your maternal great-grandparents.
Yes.
And then you have an Aunt Banner, an Aunt Fiddly, Uncle Pete, Uncle Reb. They were actual relatives of yours from another era.
That's right.
And then you have the character of a man, Bum Piles. What a name, Bum. You know,
that's a real name. He really existed. I was given his name by a masterful storyteller up in my old log cabin in West Virginia many years ago. And it was just such a remarkable story that I had to incorporate him into the book.
Well,
there's another case of where, you notice I say in the book that Paul used to call him the least among us. He said, I think he's the most best among us. And that's the idea that the innocence of youth and the kind of innocence of a pure heart is what I was trying to demonstrate in those two characters.
You have biographical sketches of various individuals, which we can chat about in a moment. But what I found very, very profound about the way that you write is how you captured the feel of an era. And it's hard for many Americans to really grasp that we had on our own grounds this horrific war that claimed the lives of over 600,000 people, and men, women, and children. And the extensiveness of this war, brother against brother, father against son, aunts and uncles against each other, it just tore families apart.
Yes.
And it was such an incredible period, a horribly violent period. Out of it came tremendous change, and you've managed to capture it. And in your book, you say this, you give this statement, somewhere along all the reasons why wars are fought, there is surely the one that says that war, as seen from a distance and away from the horrible realities of the battlefield, bears a mystical and irresistible attraction for most men. That sentence, that statement, is something that when we're listening to the news today and we are hearing about these terrorist groups that are over in the Middle East and there are young men flocking to go over to be a part of this, we're hearing about atrocities being done. And I thought to myself, here I am going to be doing this interview with you. These are these newscasts, and how little has changed. Your sentence is a very powerful statement about a character of human nature that I think for many people, including myself, is really very perplexing.
Yes. Well, I feel that it's embedded in all men, and it was there because there was a time in our history and in our development that we had to be quick to defend and to bristle up. But it and even though men are today, many men are away from, have gone beyond that, it's there and it can flare up. In the book, I have the young lad is horrified by the war, and he can't reconcile it with his own upbringing as a Christian Bible reading boy, and yet there's a place in there where somebody hands him a musket and says, here boy, fetch yourself a little glory. And he's horrified at the thought of
firing on a human being is beyond his ability to even comprehend.
Uh-huh.
And yet, when the surge of the battle comes on, and everybody is shooting and shouting and crying and dying, he's caught up in it enough that he fires the first shot he's ever fired into a crowd of men. And eventually he fires all of them that he had. And he's not horrified by it, but he's moved from one dimension to another. You'll never get over that. I think the men that see combat, I never did. I was in the Marines, but I never saw combat. But I think the men who did are never the same afterwards. There's always a part of them that remains behind on the battlefield.
I agree with that. I've talked with many men and women through the years who, having experienced that, and so many of them have what we know now as PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome,
yeah.
There is that, it's almost like they feel a part of them is so dark, or they've experienced such darkness, they don't know how to, I'll use the term, harmonize with it. It is a shadow that they carry with them always, and often there's such a sense of guilt. Such a sense of guilt, because you are responding frequently to the demands or commands of someone else. And in some instances, you need to, because your life is in danger. You must fight for it. And then afterwards, then there's this sense of, wow, did we really need to do that? Was it really necessary? And I know movies glamorize a lot of this, but there's really no glamour to it. You talk to any veteran, there is no glamour.
It's absolutely none.
It's just so poignant how you bring this information out in this book. And I think in the United States, we need to know more about our own history, because we need to understand that death and destruction that is automatically what is the result of war occurred on our own ground, and the memories and the recall of it. It's important not to glorify it, but to see how very valuable it is to perhaps think differently and to try to communicate differently to avoid the destruction. Now, 1863 is the time frame that you open your story with. And by the way, this story is totally gripping. And you state, the armies of both the North and South converged on Gettysburg with 170,000 men and 80,000 animals. And a third of those engaged lay dead, wounded, or were missing or captured. And the cleanup, and that's such a strange word to use perhaps, but to be able to take care of the mass of dead bodies, which there was over 7,000, and 4,000 of 21,000 soldiers that were injured would die. So you have now 11,000 plus. And you had 5,000 dead horses. That image, that information alone is almost incomprehensible to me. It's just, oh my goodness is all I can say.
There's one place where Charles Woodruff Battery, who's a little West Pointer, is killed in the battle, but his battery with Mormon would have about 100 horses to a battery. You know, you're in his place 50 yards square. You think of that, 150 feet by 150 feet, were 71 dead horses. The carnage and the horror of that is hard to believe, hard to imagine.
It really, really is. And
you know, another thing I'd like to say about what soldiers feel, and I've never had the experience, but I've discussed it and thought about it a lot. There is a association between men who've seen combat together that's different than anything else. It's a closer relationship than any other. Your combat friend. And when somebody is having that post-traumatic stress disorder, or as they said, World War One shell shock on the battlefield, the embrace of a comrade to a wounded man means everything. And when you've been to hell and back with someone, you never forget him. The associations I knew of combat veterans in the Marines was intense.
Absolutely
so there's
true.
That too.
There's
a place in there in the book, I think it's a page, around page 77, where I describe about, I said every army has its share of cowards. Do you remember that?
Yes. In fact, I am grabbing it up right now. Yes.
And in it, there's a number of different things that why men go forward into notable, into exceptional danger. For some, the calling is a patriotism, but it's not just patriotism. It's the leadership, the training, and the expectation to do your duty. The man to your left, the man to your right are the closest people you ever had in life. And there's that peculiar wanting to. And I said in there, I think that even so, regardless of each man's motivation, they all have fear. But somehow or other, the brave and the coward, they all go forward together.
Very true. That comradeship is exceptional, and rarely in my awareness and observation and conversation with people who have served, do they actually talk with anyone about what they've been through. They have to have that feeling of trust that will enable that conversation to go through someone who has not experienced combat with someone who has.
May I relate a little anecdote to you?
Sure.
Have you seen the film, the Spielberg film, Band of Brothers?
I have not had the occasion to see it, no. But
it's
I've heard about
it. It's the best war film I've ever seen, the most realistic. And in it, a man named Joe Torre, they're hit in the Ardennes at winter by an artillery barrage. And Joe Torre has his leg blown off. He's lying there in the snow bleeding. And Frank Guerrier, his buddy, comes under fire and picks him up. And Torre is almost incomprehensible what he's saying. He's so shocked. And so Frank Torre says, "Come on, Joe, we're going to get you out of here, Joe. Come on, Joe." And he picks him on his shoulders and he takes him out. Now, another gentleman I knew was a helicopter pilot who picked up the wounded off the battlefield in Vietnam. I knew him. He told me that when he was in Denver, Colorado, a few years ago, he's going down the hall of his hotel and he saw a sign that said, "Easy Company Reunion." And he thought, "I wonder." And he went to the door and one of the fellows said, "Can I help you?" He said, "This isn't the Easy Company from Band of Brothers, isn't it?" He said, "Sure is. Come on in." He said, "I spent some time with those guys, and you would not believe they chatted about each other like they were a bunch of young men." And Joe Torre was there with his missing leg, and Frank Guerrier, who saved him, were there. And each man, one never lost sight of what the other did to save him. And the other one looks across the table and sees the one that he knows wouldn't be there if he hadn't done what he did. That's an association that is so close. It's, you can't imagine what it must be like.
Whenever people go through difficult times, there is that comradeship. It's the communication capability. If someone's never known hunger, how can they speak to someone who has? It is very tough to be able to relate to the fears, the apprehension, the nightmares, and the various things that go on. You lay the groundwork for your primary character, who, like you said, is 12 years old. And this research that you did on Gettysburg, the environment, everything that you describe, it's almost as if you can see it, smell it, feel it, touch it. It's your writing is just so incredible. And when you are going through it, this is before the war comes in to this homestead type of environment that a family, very hardworking family, strong ethics, very, very diligent in what they do. And here's this 12-year-old boy when the news comes in that the war is coming into their environment. He gets all excited because his life is basically about the farm life and the family, and he doesn't have very much else that he's occupied with. Tell us a little bit about how you built this character and if you based him on a real person.
Well, there was a lot of my own life in that. I knew what it was to hoe corn and ride a plow horse, and I was too young to do the plowing, but I did. I learned all those things myself. So a lot of that was from firsthand experience. But the rest of it was from what I heard others say, and I'm old enough to reach back to it. A period of time when things are not that different, or not that different from the Civil War. I was born in 1932, and I remember as a boy of five, there was across the street an old man that had a little grocery store. His name was Mr. Grubb. And Mr. Grubb was in his 90s, and he had been a veteran of the Civil War. So that link of history is very close. The experience that I had in all these things comes mostly secondhand, but you can't be in all places at one time. I didn't answer your question very well, I'm afraid.
Well, you did answer it, and to a degree, but I do think.
I know one thing I mean to tell you. When I was a boy of nine, my father died before I was born. My mother remarried. And it was World War II period, and we didn't have a car. So we caught a bus up to a place in Pennsylvania, not too far from Gettysburg, where my stepfather's first wife, she died. Our father would come down in the old buckboard, drawn by the two plow horses, and pick us up at the end of the road and take us about 3 miles up to the mountains, his farm up there. That farm had no running water. It had no electricity. It had nothing that wasn't there at least 100 years before. And yet he made a living at it. And I lived there. I didn't live there, but I visited there many times and remember everything as clearly as I could possibly to this day. The deerskin rugs on the floor, the ticks, straw-filled ticks that we slept on, and like I say, the two plow horses. And that to me was partly what I wrote about in this book. Some of that's a real experience.
One of the statements you make in your story, Chester is such a wonderful, wonderful character. You say the land and its treasures were our livelihood and our welfare, and our elders demonstrated respect and reverence for all of it. And there was a comment that you made earlier when we started chatting that it's very difficult for a soldier when he's in training to back away from the religious training of thou shalt not kill. And this is something that is promoted in every church and synagogue that I'm aware of. And yet here, when you go engage in military combat, you're going to do exactly the opposite. And I remember members of my family telling me that that was one of the biggest things that they had a conflict with, because when they were going through boot camp, when they were being trained to be a soldier, this is what you did. That was your enemy. That was the bad guy over there. That's what you were supposed to do. And I think many, many times that is a very difficult thing for someone to let go of. And I think that in your research, you found that this caused a lot of anxiousness among those that were the soldiers, regardless of the side they were on.
Yes, and there's one place in there, you know, where they're all seated around it, or around the dinner table, and the rebel soldiers and their prisoners and the family home in Gettysburg. And somebody said, I guess none of us ever took this job for career or pastime. And one of them says, no, he said, the war just came and we were required to go.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, they went forward. They had to, because it took more courage to refuse than to go. And so when they did, once they got into the rush of battle, or of just of movement, when you're with the troops in a movement situation, it's like being in a raging stream going down a river of no return. You are caught up in it emotionally, physically, and you're required to be. There's no turning back. It's impossible. So these men that went forward were suddenly in situations where they were killing people in front of them, and that had to be very difficult, because I also say in there that in peacetime, if you commit violence, you're punished.
Mm-hmm.
In wartime, you're rewarded. And yet in each instance, that person on the other side can be perfectly innocent of any miscreant to you. And so I think that's one of the great tragedies of war.
I agree
with
that.
We are required to be savages.
Mm-hmm. That is something that someone once said to me, that they had a reunion with individuals that
had what?
With individuals that were from the other side. For example, during World War II,
yes.
And we're talking about the Confederate War, but during World War II, there was this group of Americans and then also some Germans. And these are officers. And they ended up having a gathering. And both of these groups of men were in their 60s or 70s when it occurred, and they're no longer at war with each other. And they shared their stories, and each of them took positionings of battle at a time in history when they had this get together. They said it was really something they didn't want to do. And I think that's hard for people to really understand.
Yes, and it again, you're caught up in it, and it's like you can't stop it. Donna, in 1990, my wife and I were hosted a dinner for three British aces and three German aces to the Battle of Britain. It was the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. We hosted it in the Army Navy Club downtown Washington. It was a lovely affair. Three German generals all had unbelievable numbers. They, like one gentleman, had over 1,100 combat missions.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
Amazing.
And they explained, they said, well, if you sometimes you went up 7 to 9 times a day in your fighter, you came down, you got fueled, you got loaded with ammunition, up you went. if you survive, you have the numbers. If you didn't survive, of course, nobody knows about those guys. Now, the interesting part of it was, at dinner, I had at my table the son, Bruce Arnold, the son of Hap Arnold, who headed the Air Force in World War II. And across the table was General Adolf Galland, who was head of the German fighter squadron at age 29, Major General at age 29. He was a pet of Hitler and of Göring. So somebody, this was right after the Berlin Wall fell, and Gorbachev was making differences. And somebody at the table said, "General Galland, what do you think of events in the Soviet Union?" And he stood up to speak, and he said, "We find these events to be incredible. And we believe that if the president of the Soviet Union can retain power, we are headed for a better world, and we should all pray for him." And he sat down. And I said, my other friend on the other side was a fellow I dedicated the book for, was 94 years old at the time. I said, "Did you in all your 90 years ever expect to hear a Nazi general beseech a patriotic American audience to pray for the German or for the Soviet president of the Soviet Union? Who wrote this script anyway?" Now, I tell that story only to say that Bruce Arnold then turned to me and said, Adolfo was with his wife Heidi on the other side of the table. He said, "George, Adolfo and Heidi and Barbara and I have been taking vacations together for 11 years. Here was a man who was the son of the guy that bombed the hell out of Germany, and the man that sent all the fighters up and went up himself to shoot him down, and they were the best of friends. And I said, "Yeah, Bruce, I hear that roaring noise. That's your father turning over in his grave. But you know, the purpose of this story is to say that. Can you imagine that those two men were the best of friends?" Mm-hmm. The wife of that Bruce, by the way, named Barbara Douglas, was the daughter of Donald Douglas of DC-10s and DC-9s, the famous air family of Douglases. And Arnold married. So it's true in every war that I've ever heard of. There have been instances. There was a case in World War One where the German troops and the American troops in their trench warfare on Christmas Eve, somebody started singing Christmas hymns, and the men got out of their trenches and met on the battlefield and exchanged gifts. And then it went back to battle after that. Now, this is how ridiculous it is to fight the way we do.
Mm-hmm. And when
all the deaths, all the tragedy, all the lost lives.
I agree.
And we had the murderous, awful thing that happened in Germany during the 30s with one war. It was murder, and now the France or here Europe is filling up with a much more formidable, in my view, enemy now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's a mentality that we have to be aware of, that we have to be vigilant. Otherwise, it's like a cancer, and it will consume it'll consume everything in its past. So it's something that we have to be alert to, and that is part of what the story of the Civil War is about, from your perspective. Also, you make the statement, heroes come in all shapes, sizes, and, you know, and talents, and that is something that is a face of war that often we are not able to see, that sometimes in the ugliest of circumstances, the brightest light will shine because of a human being's character and dedication and purpose. And I think sometimes that these events evolve because it's time for, if you will, cleanup, to take care of scrubbing out or getting rid of those very components that destroy the rights and privileges of people. And we have to stand up against those that don't want us to have it. And that is, you know, it's something that we must do. It's something that we don't want to do. But you have a statement in your book and in the context of the story. Do you not have the right, indeed the obligation, to fight someone who breaks into your house and threatens your family? Does not your honor require it? Yeah. And I think with many of the things that are going on in the world today, that we have to look at it with clear eyes and understand that there is going to have to be a standing up to what isn't right and to stand up for the rights of freedom and individuality, and not only individuality, but the right of a person to have a good life, to be able to worship as they choose to worship.
Or just have life at all.
That's right. And not to be a slave. Not to be a slave to someone else, but to be your own
person. But it is
person.
One of the greatest quandaries of all time, whether to kill or not kill in war. It's like, you know, there are times when people are led like sheep to their death.
Mm-hmm.
If they were armed and could turn and kill their captors, they would. And I would applaud them for it. On the other hand, there's people like, not people like, but there was one, Nelson Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
Who, after 27 years of wrongful captivity, emerged still a whole man and with forgiveness in his heart. If it hadn't been, that country would have been a bloodbath.
That is true.
But he said, no, reach out, embrace your brother, don't kill him. And South Africa was changed overnight.
Yes, it was. And that's what we need to remember. We need to remember those people that said there's a better way. Martin Luther King was one. Mandela is another. You have Gandhi, who said the same thing in different ways, in their own words, but saying there is a better way. We do not have to slaughter each other. It is not necessary. We need to change our thinking. We need to know that there's a better way of living on this earth so that we have a richer experience and that we don't destroy randomly. And I know that Chester, there's so many emotions that you share that I think both of the men and the women characters that you portray and sing before breakfast, George. There's one that at one time when he said he wasn't feeling very noble, here he was this young boy, 12 years old, who ended up having to become a man within a very short period of time and having responsibilities. He was just asked by a general to run messages, and he gets all excited about it. But then what he sees is just tremendously difficult for him, and he has to think. It creates a whole different person. He grows up literally within a matter of, less than 24 hours.
Well, you know, there comes a time in life where there is no clear-cut answer, that there is no perfect answer for anything. And all I can say is that what must be done is to keep trying and keep trying. And over a period of time, it does get better. And hopefully it will. A lot of people are going to suffer in the meantime. And it happens in everywhere, in Africa, in Asia. Certainly in Europe and in generations past, was a terrible place. But for anyone
You can at any time say, no, this is wrong. I'm not going to do it. It nudges us a little closer to something better than what we are. But it's going to take a long time. A long time yet, I'm afraid.
You have a quote in here. Young men go forth when cannons roar to heed the bugle's sound, where those who sowed the seeds of war are seldom to be found. And yes. I think whenever you study the history of war, whether it is in Chinese history, European history, American history, South American history, there are those small circles of individuals that are making decisions that are affecting literally the lives of millions. And they're not out there on the battlefield. And that little poem that you have in the book is so, it's so significant, because I think if those individuals were taken from their isolated positioning and put out in the forefront, they'd have a whole different demeanor.
I think so too. Well, it's the same way even when you criticize somebody for the way they handle the war. Or one of the most criticized generals that ever was Ulysses S. Grant. Ulysses S. Grant was a dogged general that determined to get the job done. It was a terrible war. There was no other way to go but to end it. And he and Sherman committed a lot of troops and a lot of battles to get it to the point where it could stop. Otherwise, you'd been like the Hundred Years' War. You'd have been fighting forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so when today, when people criticize our president for his role in how he's handling things, I'd like to see them try it. And I think that every time when I hear Lindsey Graham and the various ones that even John McCain, who I happen to admire, criticize the way the president handles things, put them in the decision seat and see how much better they can come up with it. Because what we're trying to do is defeat an enemy, win a war without putting troops on the ground. It's almost impossible. Airstrikes are one thing, but, you know, airstrikes will never change men's minds. Sometimes it stiffens spines instead of bending them.
Very true.
And so we're caught up in something that we have to learn how to deal with better than we have.
I think
but,
that's
you know,
what
I
we're
remember
seeing.
I'm old enough to remember clearly one thing about World War II that made it so exceptional. Remember, we went from, in less than 4 years, we went from a depression to the world leadership that we did in I forget what it was, 41 months or something like that. Now, that only happened for one reason. We had a country with enough people and enough resources, but more than that, Everybody, even no matter where you stood in the beginning, everybody pulled together. We're all on the same side. And we all were supporting our troops and so forth. You can't wage a half-assed war. It has to be so decisive. But on the other hand, today's war are different because they're wars of psychology, there are social wars, there are religious wars, there are all different kinds of things. They're not just clashing. I think, in a way, the old-fashioned defeat of Japan and Germany was the last of the wars that you could deal with mentally, emotionally, and intellectually. These other ones are wars where everything leaks out the edges. There's no solid thing to attack or confront because it's like trying to fill a leaky bucket. You know, you're always fighting to get it 100% you'll never get.
Your character, Bum, in your book is a man with great depth and great wisdom. And there comes that time when the war comes onto his property and he's defending Chester and he has to shoot a man. He didn't want to shoot him, but he has to shoot him. And your script here is so poignant. It says, "Dang your hide, I was hoping to get through this thing without blood on my hands, but you wouldn't let me. Dang you, all to hell and back." He was so upset, so angry. But yet, yeah. He had to defend Chester.
He had to do it.
He had to do it. And this is something that you have addressed. And also, there's so much more in your story and the various poignant stories about many different individuals. And again, this is historically accurate because you've done the research. But you have these words. You say, "An awful game is war, not just the blood and gore, when orphans, weak, and widows keep the vigil at the door. A soldier falls in pain to never rise again. To those he leaves and she who grieves, forever is the game." Those words, I think, are so important to say because you can't romanticize this reality. And I think in our world today, a lot of people want to romanticize it. We have so many things about violence and it's glorious and it's wonderful. It really isn't. It really isn't. It is something that maybe you can watch it in a television show or on a movie, but you really don't want it in real life. This is not something that really builds or creates. It destroys. In many ways, it actually will totally wipe out sometimes cultures and people.
Oh, yes.
It's everything is just destroyed, and it may take 150, 200, 300, 500 years to have something become whole again, if it ever does.
Yes. You know, in my book, I put little verses in front of every chapter.
Mm-hmm.
The one in chapter one says, "Old times done be past, yonder come to dawn, armies be amassed, old times soon be gone." And wars oftentimes move us into another phase of life nationally, and it did there. Slavery went by the boards. A lot of things happened that changed this country, but this country became a world leader in agriculture, in transportation, in invention, in road building and railroads and communication and military superiority. And I made a line in there somewhere said that as a result of the Civil War, the United States became. It was, you know, people don't realize they're living today how loosely the United States were as in, they weren't really a nation. They were a confederation of states. And the southern states always wanted to stay the same because they had a good life. The northern states were in motion all the time. And the clash was bound to come. But the Civil War turned us into a world power without which I'm not sure who would have stood against Hitler or the Japanese or the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
World role today.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm proud of this country because this country has never sought territory. As General Colin Powell said, except for the ones that are where they're buried.
You have a quote in your book by a young Confederate officer who was and had been involved with the terrible 4 years of the Civil War. And I think that this is so poignant because it really is relevant today. And this is what he said. "As we lay there watching the bright stars, many a soldier asked himself the question, what is all of this about? Why is it that 200,000 men of one blood and one tongue, believing as one man in the fatherhood of God and the universal brotherhood of man, Should in the 19th century of the Christian era be thus armed with all the improved appliances of modern warfare and seeking one another's lives? We could settle our differences by compromising and all be at home in 10 days. I think people hearing those words would say, wow, couldn't we do that today?
Quote. I didn't write that. That's a quotation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Your book is a very powerful one. And I think, George, the illustrations in here, your documentation of various biographical sketches of the different officers that commanded various parts of the action of the Civil War, it is amazing what you were able to put together. And you even have a woman, Matilda Tilly Pierce.
Yes.
As you mentioned in here, she was 15 years old when the Confederate War was going on. And there's just so much. And you have it from both sides, the North and the South. And when you put this together and you finished it, what were your feelings?
Well, I think one of the first feelings was, well, I finally did it. I finally got it done. And that was a good feeling. Closure on something that had been nagging at me for a long time. And I knew that it was, I'd done a nice job on it, but I had no idea that it would receive the reviews that it has. I have, you can go to Amazon, you can go to Civil War News, you can go to various places, and every review I've got is are all positive. There's not one bad thing anybody has said about it, which I find astonishing. Usually in every book, somebody says, yeah, well, it didn't really happen that way. Nobody has come forward and said that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you have put together a story that, though it's in a fiction format, it is a factional publication because you have put in so much of really what the lifestyle was at that time. And you have so much of historical documentation that you've brought in as well. I think all of this together makes your book Sing Before Breakfast exceptionally powerful. And I wanted to share with people that they can find out more about your publication, singbeforebreakfast.com. That's the title of the book. It's a story of Gettysburg, but it's more than just a story of a piece of American history. It is a story about war, about how it changes people, about the effects of it. No matter where you are in this world of ours, when war comes into your environment, it is a shift and change that too often you have absolutely no control over. And so you have to go through all kinds of adaptations, adjustments, or like many people today, you become refugees and you're running for your life. You're taking what little bit you can maybe put on your back if you're able to do that, with your family, friends, whatever, so that you have a chance to survive. You are not wanting to be a part of that war, but it affects you deeply. And there comes that time when you have to stand and you have to say, this is not acceptable. And that is what I think, and more, that this book, Sing Before Breakfast, A Story of Gettysburg, is all about. I think your stories, George, that you've shared today, whether it was about World War II or people that you've known in the past, the story still has the same essence, that there has to be a better way for life to be lived. But sometimes we have to do stand, and we have to stand for what we know is the right thing to do. And the glory of war? Well, I guess it all depends on one's perspective. But usually there isn't the glory. There's the reality of what's left behind for those that have lost loved ones.
Oh, yes.
And so much more. George, it's been a... Excuse me, go
very
ahead.
Very little glory, very little glamour. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, George, it's been a delight having you as a guest on the show. Thank you for being with me, and I hope you'll keep up your writing.
Very much, Donna. Thank you so much.
It has been my pleasure. My guest today, George Stein, the book, Sing Before Breakfast. We have just a few moments left, and in those moments, I wanted to share a quote with you. I often will review materials, and I come across statements made by people that I think are really important for us to hear. Henry Van Dyke is a man that wrote quite a bit, and he said, "There is a life that's worth living now as it was worth living in the former days, and that is the honest life, the useful life, the unselfish life, cleansed by devotion to an ideal. There is a battle worth fighting now as it was worth fighting then, and that is the battle for justice and equality. To make our city and our state free in fact as well as in name. To break the rings that strangle real liberty and to keep them broken. To cleanse, so far as in our power lies, the fountains of our national life from political, commercial, and social corruption. To teach our sons and daughters by precept and example the honor of serving such a country as America. That is work worthy of the finest manhood and womanhood." America is not just a piece of land. The American soul represents the spirit of freedom, the love of being able to communicate, as I'm communicating with this show today, to be able to make choices about where you want to work, where you want to live, how you want to live. You have a right to be a bum on the street or to be president of a country. You have that right. You have that choice. You have that privilege. But always, you've got to stand firm for what you know is the right thing to do. There is so much that goes on in the world that preoccupies us. Our lives are busy, and we wonder, what difference can we make? As individuals, I would say, read. Be willing to study history. Be willing to learn from those that have gone before us. Listen and think about their stories. And really get the facts, because it makes a tremendous difference. When you hear the truth, when you hear the stories of the veterans and the people that have been on the front lines of the agonies of war, you never forget those stories. And they make you aware that many times you have to stand up for what you really believe in. Let's hope it doesn't have to go into that direction. But it seems like there is a clamor going on right now of those individuals that are saying, we don't want you to have the rights and freedoms. We want to be able to dominate and control. In my lifetime, I've seen a great deal of this, and it has been in just about every country on this planet. And in the United States, there's such diversity, and I'm very grateful for it, because it allows us to make choices to be who we want to be. Are we perfect? Far from it. But you know what? I sure am glad I'm here. This is Donna Sebo. Won't you join me for the Donna Sebo Show that's heard weekly from 9 to 10 Pacific Time? And don't forget Wednesdays, Warriors for Peace.
This
More
is
good things
Sebo.
To come.
Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.